Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. The need to build out broadband across Vermont seems to be universally agreed upon, but we've made various attempts to get it done with limited results. Franklin County Senator Randy Brock is a member of the Senate Finance Committee and the Joint Information Technology Oversight Committee. He wrote a commentary recently on the subject of broadband, and he joins us now to discuss it. Senator Brock, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much for having me this morning.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Senator Brock about his thoughts on broadband or to share your own, we're at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Senator Brock, let's start out. What are your thoughts about the need for broadband in the state?
Well, I think it's absolutely critical. It's a critical economic development tool, and it takes Vermonters from the 20th century clearly into the 21st. The pandemic has shown us, without a doubt, how critical telecommunications is. People had to go to work remotely, people had to go to school remotely, and people, for the first time, had real opportunity to do medical care remotely. But we now are in a situation in which we almost have two Vermonts. We have a Vermont that's connected, often in our more populated areas, and then we have large portions of Vermont that are in an internet desert, and that's the problem.
Yeah, how adequate is what the state currently has, Senator Brock?
Well, right now we have, and this is from memory, so I won't don't stick me with the actual statistical number, but I think it's about 280,000 addresses that have the potential of being connected in Vermont, and we have another somewhere between 52 and 66,000 that don't have adequate broadband service. And adequate service means the federal standard of 25 megabits down and 3 megabits up. That standard will enable you to do Zoom meetings. It will enable you to look at movies over the internet and so on. But it's not truly world-class service. It's not the class of service that enables you to do really intensive business. And that's one of the things that we need. If we're going to have economic development throughout Vermont so that no community or area is left behind, we have to get top-class internet service throughout. Many people say, for example, that even residential service is so important that it may add up to $5,000 to the value of a home if that home has the ability to get high-speed internet. Well, and our goal in all of this is to finally deliver on the promise that so many governors have made in the past, that we're going to cover, from the standpoint of broadband, every location in Vermont that's on the grid.
Now, Senator, you know, the free enterprise system says that where there's demand, and there's obviously demand for this broadband, this high-speed internet throughout the state, you know, that business will fill in, will rise to meet that demand with supply. So why haven't we gotten there?
Well, that sounds like the argument that we heard in the 1920s about electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my old home in Ripton didn't get electricity till 1961.
Oh, man.
So, you know, there is a the competitive market is great when you have the possibility of competition. But if you're 2 miles up the end of a road in East Overshoe, you're not going to get broadband because there isn't enough population to make it profitable for a provider to string that wire or cable, or in this case, what we're really talking about is optical fiber.
So there's federal aid available now to take care of this need, but you're a bit frustrated about how the legislature is going about it. Why is that?
Well, it's whenever you're in the legislature, you're frustrated. That goes with the territory.
I understand.
Because you have 180 people with 180 different ideas, and of course, you know, you're the only one who's right.
I'm glad I got the person who's right on the phone today.
But that being said, I think we are making progress, but we have a debate, and we don't always agree on how best to do it. We've created a structure called a Communications Union District, a CUD, mm-hmm. and these are effectively municipalities. They come about when multiple towns in a region get together, decide to create a CUD, and that CUD is an entity that is effectively a municipality, and it can be charged with creating a plan to string fiber, which is the optical fiber is the modern equivalent of wire, to serve all the addresses in that community or group of communities. That's a great idea, and it's a way, much like some of the rural telephone projects in the 1930s, moved to ensure that everybody had telephone, and some of the utility companies that to ensure that everybody had electricity. We need to ensure that everybody has broadband, but at the same time, we have a robust commercial market that actually serves about 80% of the addresses in Vermont right now to one extent or another. Now, in some cases, what's provided is expensive and people can't afford it, and I'll come back to the affordability issue later, mm-hmm. which I think is a really important piece. Yep. And in other cases, these providers provide it to people in the areas that are densely populated, but even in the same town don't provide it to areas that are sparsely populated. And that's what we're trying to deal with. Now, the competitive market is something that I don't think any of us want to get rid of by any means. And indeed, one of the things that we're encouraging is that CUDs enter into agreements, partnerships of one kind or another, public-private partnerships that allow them to coordinate with and collaborate with private providers if it makes sense to the overall goal. And that's beginning to happen.
Now, these private providers haven't made it to that last mile, to that guy, you know, 2 miles down the road in East Overshoe, where it's not profitable. The CUDs say, you know, we're less concerned about profit. We want to do that. Why would the private providers now want to help the CUDs get to that end of the street there?
Well, there could be a variety of arrangements that a CUD could enter into with a private provider. For one thing, private providers in some cases have the trucks and the manpower to string cable, which the CUDs are going to have to invent from scratch. Mm-hmm. Private providers in some cases have content that can be transmitted on the CUDs lines to bring television programming and other kinds of services to people at the end of the road. And so there's a way that both parties can conceivably benefit and profit from doing this by getting better and more content and more services to people on the one hand, and then bringing those services to people that are too expensive for the private provider to reach in a conventional way.
If you looked at the overall performance of the state, what have we done right so far, and what where are we lacking? Where haven't we gotten it right?
Well, it's not what we haven't done right, because we're handicapped, mm-hmm. as is every other rural state. We're handicapped, sure. because the federal preemption laws prevent us from regulating the Internet in any way. If this were a telephone company, let's take the conventional wired telephone company, we have carriers of last resort who, in return for the ability to sell their services in the marketplace, they have, in effect, either exclusive territory.
Oh, boy. So I think we might have lost Randy Brock. All right, Senator Brock, great to have you back.
Thank you.
You were really going, and then all of a sudden we lost the line. So I do want to ask, though.
Well, it was probably an Internet service provider that didn't like what I was saying.
That could be, although you seem to be giving them fair assessment. What kind of governmental entity should be in place to oversee the build-out of broadband in the state?
Well, in my opinion, it should be a separate entity from the entities that we have right now. My preference is to recreate something called the Vermont Telecommunications Authority, which was a function that was started a number of years ago, and 4 or 5 years ago was mothballed because it wasn't accomplishing what it was supposed to, and that is to get some sanity about how we go about expanding broadband. One of their major problems, of course, was they didn't have any money. And so, as a result, they were almost doomed to failure. But now we have money. We have the money to do this, and it's imperative that we do it right. We have an historic opportunity to follow through on all the promises that we've made of getting ubiquitous broadband throughout Vermont. And it's critical that we do it right. And in my mind, doing it right means things like providing an entity that oversees the process, particularly where there's public money involved, and that's the key, where there's public money involved, to ensure that we have a coordinated effort that makes sense.
Who do you think should be part of that entity? You don't have to name names, but in other words, what type of people should be part of this and guiding how we use these funds properly?
Well, I think it should be led by what I almost refer to as a broadband czar. And by that, I don't mean a dictatorial kind of leader, but I do mean someone who is energized, who's charged, who's got the background and experience to bring together all of these disparate parts, many of which are operating independently, and simply coordinate the effort to make sure that we're all going at full speed in the right and in the same direction. An example, you go back to the 19th century, there were situations in which various companies were building railroads. And let's say two railroads were built from opposite directions, joined at town A. And when they got to town A, they found that the first railroad built 4.5-foot gauge track, the second railroad built 5-gauge track, and the two didn't connect.
Right.
We have to make sure, and you know, that's a wild example, and it's not that I expect to see that kind of thing happen here in Vermont.
Sure.
But things like common engineering standards, the assurance that there would be effective interconnection and exchange, I think is important. Try to prevent overbuilding. In other words, try to prevent duplication. To use the best and most competent way to get fiber strung. For example, if a tree falls on a power line, do you send one truck out or do you send two? Would you send one to protect the power, to fix the power line, another to fix the cable, another to fix the telephone line, and so on? And these are just things to think about and see, is there a better way of doing it so that we're not wasting money duplicating things? Is there a better way to coordinate the efforts, particularly in towns that have both legacy providers and new entrants, again, to deal with open access, meaning to share fiber in a, you know, a commercial rental sense so that we're not putting up stuff that doesn't need to be installed because that adds cost regardless of who has to do it. Somebody needs to coordinate these kinds of efforts. And with the CUDs, these are brand new entities. They're filled with and staffed by with boards of very interested and active volunteers, but they don't have a track record. And I think that the public needs some assurance that where we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars, there's some oversight to ensure that we aren't doing dumb things.
What you're talking about, you know, does take a little bit of time, no matter what we do. And as we mentioned at the very top, there are needs that are present right now because of the pandemic. We've learned quite a bit of what the needs were during this pandemic. So what can be done in the interim to meet some of the needs that are present right now?
Well, there is a proposal that I introduced. It really is the brainchild of Tom Evslin. And you might remember Tom. He was the recovery officer during
Irene.
The economic downturn. And it's called the concept is called Broadband Now. And it recognizes that we've extended broadband lines that cross thousands of houses in front of them, but they're not connected to the internet because the people in those houses can't afford to. they can't afford a $60 or $70 or $80 a month bill or higher to connect. And they can't afford to buy the equipment, the modems, and other kinds of things that would require that would be required to connect to lines that already exist. And so, although we're focused with the CUDs on these 50 or 60,000 locations that have no broadband, we have a lot of people in which broadband is in their front yard, and they don't have any broadband. Mm. And what this proposal does is it says, look, we can build all the cable and wiring and fiber that we want, but we haven't accomplished anything unless the people are connected to it and able to use it. And so this Broadband Now concept says we need to take some of this federal money and devote it to education, outreach, and meeting the needs of the low-income people who can't afford the Internet the way it's priced right now in many areas. Broadband, the concept in the bill is to create a broadband core, and that was something that was suggested in a fairly detailed report that the Public Service Department commissioned about how to deal with emergency broadband issues during the pandemic. The broadband core is a limited service, sort of like an AmeriCorps, to just advise people of, here's how to get broadband, here are the things that are available to you, here are the low-income programs, here's how to do it without spending money. And there are lots of, most of the major providers have low-income programs that are either free or $10 a month internet connection programs. But you take Consolidated. Okay. Telephone has a low-income program, and only 10% or so of the people eligible for it have signed up because people don't always know about it. And, you know, when people – and you think about people who don't have broadband and who are mystified about how to get it for nothing and or for low cost and how to connect to it, well, they can't go Google that and look up how to do it.
True.
And so this concept is to create this core, have it be live just for 2 or 3 years during the time in which we have the federal money available to pay for it. So it doesn't require tax increases and so on to do it. To be able to provide that instruction, that hand-holding, that connectivity, to get people through that process, to get low-income people signed up. And lots of the providers have low-income plans. Now, we also suggested that these CUDs also be in their business plan charged with creating a low-income plan that wouldn't be effective for 4 or 5 years before it would have to kick in, to give them time to develop a business plan to build up the customer base to be able to support that. And the idea is you think about airplanes and airlines. You know, an airline starts a new route, and when an airline is filling the plane, the first seats tend to be expensive to buy because they don't have the volume of passengers. But by the time the plane is full down the road, the seats at the back of the plane, they can sell for next to nothing because it's all incremental revenue at that point. You know, the flight has been paid for. And so as a result, that's a way to get a low-income plan. Some of the CUDs don't like that idea at all because they believe that it shifts some of the costs to other people on their route, and that's probably true. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it doesn't require the taxpayer to subsidize forever individuals. And again, we can provide, using that kind of a thought process, internet connectivity at a low level at a much lower price. So that's one. Now, that particular proposal was not accepted by the committee. And so we have in the bill right now, we have nothing for low-income people. Mm. And we have nothing to be able to expand the connectivity other than so-called the line extension program, which is a limited program. But we don't have what's really necessary to take thousands of people who have internet available to them now to be able to actually connect them to the internet.
I'm going to zoom back out to the long term. I got you. I'm going to zoom back out to the long term. So what kind of timeline do we need to set to get statewide broadband internet completed throughout the state of Vermont?
Well, if everything goes well, my guess is from 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. The CUDs, and some of them are saying, hey, we can cover our entire territory in 3 years. I'm skeptical.
Gotcha. I also sense your frustration reading the commentary that you wrote with getting this moving expediently in the legislature. Has your message been gaining traction to move on, to get this through as quickly as possible?
Well, we're going to get something passed. There's no question about that. And that's something in the Senate will probably pass either today or tomorrow. We'll have a bill, and then I'm sure it'll have to go to a conference committee with the House that's passed somewhat different legislation. The bill is not what I really want to see the way it's structured right now. It's not as comprehensive as I believe it should be. It doesn't have the leadership and vision. It doesn't have the scope that I think it should have. For example, it solely is limited to broadband. It's solely really focused on the CUDs, and it's solely focused on the places where there's no service, and is largely silent about all the other issues. And yes, we have 50 to 60,000 unconnected homes, but we have thousands of homes throughout Vermont that have internet that don't have access to people who need it because of pricing and other kinds of consideration, or just simply lack of knowledge. So we haven't dealt with the affordability issue either currently or prospectively at all. That's been left out. We haven't dealt with mobile wireless. And mobile wireless, by that, I simply mean cell phones. Right. And to me, if you're going to have an authority that deals with telecommunications, it needs to deal with all telecommunications, not just broadband. It needs to deal with fixed wireless as well. And that, you know, we know that just as deficient as we are about broadband throughout Vermont, we're also deficient about cell phone connectivity. And these telecommunications methods are converging. It's not that they all exist each in their own individual little boxes. They're all related. And if you're driving down the highway and you need 911, if you're close to the internet, you can get internet connectivity to your cell phone in order to dial 911. If you don't, you can't. I think we need to think about the totality of the telecommunications issues. And so from that standpoint, I think that's an essential piece that we've left out and not touched at all. I think we need to deal with planning. Yeah. The Public Service Department is required to have a 10-year telecommunications plan, and it's been more than 10 years since they've had one. If you don't have a plan, you don't know where you're going unless you have a roadmap or something to tell you how to get there. And the absence of that plan is a severe deficiency. There's a plan now that is supposed to be done by the Public Service Department. I think it's in June or July.
Senator Brock, I'm going to cut you off there. I need to get you back into your meeting. We're out of time, but I do want to thank you for being on today. This was really interesting. Thanks so much for your perspective, Rick.
Thanks for the time.
All right, take care.
All right,
Franklin County Senator Randy Brock. Let's take a break for the CBS News update. When we return, we're going to open up the phones for a half hour. And a reminder, we've got the Sox tonight. 6:10 is when we start our broadcast, 7:10 first pitch against Detroit. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, phones are open, so let's go to it. 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK, and that's what you're invited to do. Let's see. What's got you cheesed? How about if I was driving right now instead of in the studio, I'd have a list a mile long of driving pet peeves. And I'd say my biggest. So I use cruise control, and I'll be using it set at a specific speed forever. And for the last 13.7 miles, I've been gaining on this little Prius. No offense if you drive a Prius. And then when I get within 20 feet of it, all of a sudden, they're at Thunder Road. and I'm not going to get past them this week. Boom, they take off, right? What happened? I mean, save the planet, dude. I just don't get it. You were going 68 the whole time, and then I come up on you, and now I can't pass. Or the one who zips by you at 80 miles an hour. You know this person. They pull in front of you, and then they power down their Millennium Falcon to 65. Please, go fly in a distant galaxy. That's what drives me crazy. You know, if you're going to pass me at 80, go 80. Just go. Get out of my sight. Keep going. I don't want to see you anymore. Instead, you slow down, and now I got to pass you. I don't want to do that. All right, that's my driving pet peeves. What are yours? 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Let's see. Yesterday we heard from John about his possible brush with fame when his lyrics were transcribed and used by the Dead and Dylan. So it brings up, you know, the subject of celebrity near misses. Have you had any? I was from here to there away from Prince Charles once as he walked right towards me, but I stepped out of his way. Yesterday I told about my near starring role in the movie Blowout with John Travolta. Yeah, I was so close. Yeah. Let's see, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. 244-1777. Hop on. I got open phones. I got a half hour that you can take this opportunity to have a little fun. You can ask me embarrassing questions. You can preach to the converted, whatever you want to do. Of course, you can pick your own subjects. 244-1777. 877-291-8255. You don't get this opportunity in many places. You just call in and talk about what you want. We just heard from Randy Brock, senator from where? From what county? Fairfield County? No, Franklin County. I'm sorry, Franklin County. I'm making up counties here. Franklin County about broadband build out. If you have thoughts on that, maybe you've been sitting there waiting at the last mile, or you know, 4 feet from hookup, but haven't been able to get, you know, a utility company to bring you high-speed internet. I'd love to hear your story, because it happens quite a bit in the state. We've got the federal money now to make this work. You heard what Randy Brock had to say about it. I'd love to hear what you have to say about it. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. 8255. Now, we got a call coming in. Again, give us a call, or you can always email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Of course, that would mean you'd have to have, you know, internet or at least 4G on your phone to be able to send in, but feel free to do that. All right. Again, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. 8255. Oh, we're going to one of my favorite towns in the state, the home of Lincoln Gap, which I like to hike up. Is that where we're going? Maybe not. Anyway, I love hiking up Lincoln Gap in the winter with my hammerhead sled and taking a good ride down there. We are going, John, in, oh, Jerusalem. John, how you doing?
Hi, Rick. My given name is John, but my friends call me Will. I was the you interviewed me yesterday.
Oh yeah, how you doing, yeah. John?
Yeah, so I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to follow up on a couple of things. One is I wanted to finish my Dylan story. I was going to time it before I called, so I wouldn't like be yarning on everybody's ear and, you know, get it done really quick. So if you don't mind, I'd like to finish it.
All right, let's hear your Dylan story.
Okay, so
Sylvia was the song.
Sylvia was the song. So there was a place off JFK Boulevard that's right outside Harvard Square. It's a park called Winthrop Park. It's named after the first governor of the Bay Colony. You know, this guy came up to, I was singing Sylvia, an early version of Sylvia, and this guy came up and he asked me about the song, and he asked me if he could play it. I said, sure, you can play it. And he asked me if I could sell it to him, and I said, I wrote it because I gave him the Woody Guthrie line. I said, it's a Woody Guthrie copyright. I wrote it because I wanted to write it. I wrote it because I wanted to sing it. And if you want to sing it too, you can sing it. Just go ahead and do it. And I packed up my case, and I walked down past Grendel's Den, down to Elliott Street and went into a bar called Charlie's Kitchen, which I believe is still there, and sat down at the bar and ordered a shot of Jameson's and a Bass Pale Ale.
As one does.
As one does after one performs, after one busks in Harvard Square.
Right.
I was sitting there and I looked down the bar and this guy came in and it looked to me like a guy whose name is Bob Dylan. I'm not saying that it was Bob Dylan. And you know, I just want to say that none of these stories are meant to, make a claim against anyone's intellectual property. I claim fair use and I also claim fair use to reference historical figures in my fiction, which is actually true, but it's
all right. That's right.
For legal purposes.
So the guy who used to be known as Robert Zimmerman, now known as Bob Dylan, or at least a reasonable facsimile thereof, is down the bar.
Yeah, I just want to be careful because, I mean, like, he has an army of lawyers. Bob Dylan actually has his own State Department and his own army. I don't know if people know that.
We're learning a lot.
But I want to say one before you shut me off because I'm yarning too much. Mm-hmm. Before, we went through Silvio, and the one fun thing that I remember about writing the song Silvio with this guy at the bar was he was like challenging me. I felt like this was like my graduate folk song thesis defense. Mm. And so it's like he said, "What's the chorus?" And I said, "It's Silvio, silver and gold, and I gotta go." And he said, "I got to go do what?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, it's your song. You got to know." And so I was looking around the bar. And so this is in Harvard Square. And I don't know if you know the name B.F. Skinner. But there was a behavioral scientist who named B.F. Skinner who lectured at Harvard who used to drink at Charlie's Kitchen. So I looked at B.F. Skinner. And B.F. Skinner was famous for wearing these cheesy plaid sports coats. Mm. And contemporary at the time, Steve Martin made a movie called Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Oh yeah.
So there's this guy down at the end of the bar. He's challenging me. He says, "Come up with the last line to this thing." And I said, "Find out something only dead men know." Because I looked at B.F. Skinner. And he was wearing this plaid jacket, and Steve Martin had just done this this movie called Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. So I went through this whole thing. When I came in, as I said before, I had this thing called dissociative identity disorder. When he came in, I freaked out, and I was like, the only way I can do this is I can remember rationally going through the process of saying, you need to be somebody else to talk to Bob Dylan, because Will was freaking out. So I said, I need to be a songwriter. So I decided that I was Robert Hunter.
Oh, the Robert Hunter who yesterday you told us co-wrote a couple songs with, Touch of Grey and Run for the Roses.
Yeah, because I was familiar with him. Dylan and Hunter are two of my favorite songwriters.
All right, I am going to give you a minute to wrap up the Dylan story.
Okay, so I just want to give stand up for Bob Dylan because a lot of people give Dylan a bad rap about stealing stuff. He's actually just borrowed stuff. I was at the bar. I asked him. I pleaded with him to record the song. He said, "I won't record it unless you tell me what your name is." And I said, "I don't want to tell you my name." And he said, "Well, I'm not going to record it unless you tell me my name. Tell you what your name is." Mm-hmm. And I said, "My name is Robert Hunter." And he looked at me and said, "You're a liar. You're not Robert Hunter." And I banged my fist down on the bar and I said, "What?" And he jumped out of his chair and he ran out of the bar.
But nonetheless.
That's the only reason I can think of that Robert Hunter's name's on it.
All right, John. Hey, I appreciate hearing back from you. Thanks so much for calling again. That's John, who we had on yesterday, also claims to have co-written with Robert Hunter Touch of Grey and Run for the Roses, which became Grateful Dead songs. Let's go to Middlesex and talk to Ray. Hi, Ray.
Hi there. My biggest pet peeve is the people driving these roundabouts. For God's sakes, people, learn how to drive in them.
Yeah.
I've had people in the circle, and they stop to let someone in.
Yeah.
Why?
Yep. I don't
know. That's not the purpose of a roundabout. The purpose of a roundabout is to keep the traffic flowing. Or if somebody's coming from Montpelier into the roundabout, and they see somebody coming from Barrie into the roundabout, they'll stop and sit there and wait to see if they're going to come all the way around or go to East Montpelier, or if they're going to Montpelier, they'll wait.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't wait, people. You got plenty of time. Drive through it.
Yep. Ray, where are you from originally?
Middlesex.
Oh, okay. So, all right, good. So I just wanted to make sure you weren't from Mass, because they've had roundabouts forever. Roundabouts, you know, are kind of a reintroduction, but we haven't had them in Vermont for a long time, you know, these new ones. And so I know a lot of people approach them as if they're coming to their first ever roundabout. And maybe, you know, there needs to be a class, there needs to be, you know, outreach, because you're absolutely right. The most dangerous thing about roundabouts are the people who don't know how to function in them. Or I've learned, Ray, that if I've got somebody in front of me, you know, where I'm coming into a roundabout, I used to look at the roundabout to see that traffic, you know, because then you see there's no traffic and you assume this person starts to pull forward, that you can just go right up and wait for your turn, but they stop and you can rear end them. So I keep my eyes right on the car in front of me that's trying to go get into the roundabout, because you have no idea how they're going to react. So keep the faith, oh, yeah, Ray. Do your best.
It's not a stop sign.
I know it isn't.
It's
a yield sign. You are absolutely right. I'm going to make you the czar of roundabouts. Ray, the czar of roundabouts in Vermont. Thank you for that call. It's a great one. All right. We go to Corinth next and talk to Forbes. Hi, Forbes. What's up?
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. What's going on?
Talking about broadband before, but
yeah.
Let's get back to some basics.
Okay.
Electricity. We have 20 miles of energized line, poles, transformers, and whatnot, with 20 customers.
Mm-hmm.
We remove 10 of those customers from the system with alternative energy, solar panels, various other things.
Mm-hmm.
Is it now out of the goodness of the heart of the utility companies to make an adjustment so that the remaining people that are on the line who can't afford solar panels have to make up that difference of loss? Or is it a public service responsibility to address this? An example, my bill for 10 years at least hasn't exceeded $43. It is now $77 average per month.
You know, I don't think, I think to answer your first question, and again, I'm just guessing, but I don't think that a utility would micro, you know, manage an area and say, okay, you know, this street, it takes, you know, it now costs us more to get it down this street. Any cost would be absorbed across the whole network, you know, everyone that they provide power to. And so you shouldn't see any appreciable difference, you know, that they've lost 10 customers in your area. I could be wrong, but everything's strung up already. You know, the infrastructure's in place and it's built. So it shouldn't be any more expensive than it was before when you had 20 users and now you have 10. That's my thought. Now, when you're building it out, it's a little different because you have to build that infrastructure, and that is that upfront cost, and you make these new subscribers shoulder it. And I could be way wrong, but that's my thought on how it would work.
Okay. Well, the thing is, we have loss of revenue. So to make up that loss of revenue, the remaining people who are still plugged in have got to make up that loss of revenue through alternative methods, reducing their revenue.
Right.
I'm just saying, who looks after this? Who addresses that particular problem?
Well, that would be our Public Utilities Commission.
Could you get somebody in maybe sometime and let them explain what they're doing to amortize this loss of revenue to the remaining people that are still plugged in?
Yeah, and I'm going to say, too, I don't think we've lost so many power customers in that utility that it would affect your bill by $30 a month. There's probably something else going on there, but I could be wrong, and I think you're right. I do need to have someone in to explain how our bill is calculated and how losing customers or gaining customers would affect that. So, Forbes, great call.
Okay.
Thanks for the homework.
Thank you.
All right. I appreciate hearing from you. All right. Where do we go next? Newbury, Fred? Hi, Fred.
Hello. Hi. Hey, this is interesting. I love presidential politics, and now I'm beginning to think President Biden is flying Air Force One too close to the sun.
Because?
All his politics. All his plans. He wants, he's going big. He's spending all this money. He's flying too close to the sun.
He certainly, I have addressed this before, he certainly has stacked up trillions of dollars of proposals, infrastructure, America Families Plan, COVID relief. We're talking trillion after trillion. We will be talking at 10:30 with Congressman Peter Welch about his thoughts on this. Is it the right thing? You and I've mentioned this before. We're in a global pandemic. We've seen an amazing hit to jobs and production drops. People have less money. Do we need to stimulate the economy? And at what point is enough enough? Great questions, Fred. Go ahead, quickly.
When Icarus flew too close to the sun, what happened?
His wings melted.
That's right. That's what I'm afraid is going to happen to the president.
All right. Thanks so much, Fred. All right. We've got time maybe for a call here at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Talking about presidential politics, talking about broadband, your driving pet peeves, or your near-miss celebrity encounters. Those are all things you can ask about. I have homework from Forbes to talk about utility pricing and how changes in usage will affect that. We did hear from Stephen in Montpelier yesterday, and he did ask – he mentioned going to give blood and taking his dog with him, and someone – mentioned that the dog could give blood. Now, I don't think there, where the human blood is being taken, but both me, the guest, we had never heard of anything like this before. Stephen had never heard of it before and wondered about the veracity of it. Well, I did do my homework, and it is a thing. And so tomorrow, during the 10 o'clock hour, we'll all learn about this. Your dog can give blood, and there is a need for this. It is a thing. BEVS, which is the Burlington Emergency Veterinary Services, they do this. And we'll have Katie Hamilton from BEVS on tomorrow during the 10 o'clock hour. And if you're a pet owner, you'll be able to learn all about it. Should be quite interesting. That is brand new to me. I thought I knew everything. I absolutely thought I knew everything there was to know in this world. And yesterday I learned a brand new thing. So how about that? You learn something new every day, they say. All right, Danny, I think that's it. The phones, they are closed. We'll pick it up again tomorrow. And we're going to break now for CBS News. When we come back, we're going to talk about mentoring opportunities. And I want to remind you today at 1, we'll bring you the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. And then that's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with the incredible Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We are a state full of people looking to help others. And it doesn't take long to learn when you get here that this is the Vermont way. It's firmly ensconced in the DNA of native Vermonters. And those from away pick it up. They pick up the mantle once they observe how Vermonters treat one another. But what if you have an interest in mentoring but don't know exactly where to find an organization to help? Or if you aren't familiar with a group that could really benefit from your interests and skill set? They used to go by the name Mobius and now are called Mentor Vermont. And as we're going to learn shortly, they can get you connected to the right organization. Here to tell us about the work of Mentor Vermont is Chad Butt, their executive director. Chad, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to ask about mentorship opportunities, or if you want to share one that you've been involved with, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Chad, what exactly is Mentor Vermont?
So Mentor Vermont is the statewide sort of umbrella organization that supports adult to youth mentoring around the state. There's about 30 different mentoring agencies, nonprofits, prevention coalitions, or school districts that have mentoring programs around the state. And we provide support and resources and systems for them at scale, and also funding to make sure that they're able to meet the needs of their community and the youth that they serve.
I mentioned that the name changed from Mobius a few years ago. Did anything else change since then?
No, we really have maintained the same work that we were doing since 2013 when we expanded just from serving Chittenden County as an umbrella organization to statewide, and also took over some funding that we'd get from the state of Vermont and also from the A.D. Henderson Foundation. But with the name change that happened a few years ago, really it was just to better align the work we do with what people hear when they hear our name. Mentor Vermont sort of rings true with the work that we do a little bit better than Mobius did.
It says it all in two words. What is the mission of Mentor Vermont?
So for Mentor Vermont, our mission is to support youth mentoring programs in Vermont so they can meet the needs of the young people in their community, with the ultimate vision that every young person in Vermont has the supportive mentoring relationships they need to grow and develop and thrive into productive and engaged adults.
Why do you think people should get involved in mentoring?
It's a great opportunity, especially during this time where the pandemic has really impacted youth. It has impacted everybody in our state, but youth in particular. It's just a great opportunity for someone to be involved in their community and to have a really rewarding experience, not just for the youth, but for the mentor as well, to connect with someone who's a different age than you, to give back, but also to experience new experiences together and learn together.
What do you hear from mentors that they get out of this experience?
When we look at just the feedback we get from mentors, 96% of mentors say that they would recommend mentoring to a friend or a coworker or colleague or even a family member. And so we know that mentors are really enjoying their experience just from that data. But we hear stories all the time that mentors are expressing that they get more out of the experience than they think they give to the youth. We hear that it gets people out and about and doing activities they never would have done before. Me personally, I'm mentoring currently. I've been mentoring a youth from the Burlington area through the King Street Center, which is in Burlington. We've been paired for 4 years there. He's going on. He's in junior in high school right now. And one of the new things for me, I've been mentoring off and on for 20 years now, and I never actually taught a teenager how to drive. So for me, it was a new experience taking him out and doing driver's ed in my car. We checked with our our mentor coordinator to make sure it was okay with their insurance. I got some student driver stickers for my car, and off we went before the pandemic. That's what we were doing. That was a new experience for me and definitely got me doing something different that I'd never done before, which was pretty rewarding seeing him actually get his driver's license during the pandemic after doing that for a while with him.
Oh, Chad, congratulations. That is really great. Gotta love that. Yeah, good for you and good for your mentee. Now, I want to talk about matching, and I'll start on the macro level. How do you find the right mentoring match? And I mean, you know, an organization that's right for someone to be a mentor in.
Definitely. So for folks that are out there listening that want to get involved, the easiest way to do it is just to go to mentorvt.org. And on our website, we have the ability for you to search by county and figure out what programs are in your area that you might want to get involved in that might fit your needs and your time commitment and the youth that you want to serve in terms of age range and program model. But you also can just reach directly out to us. There's an inquiry form and just sort of provide a little more information. And we take it from there and talk with you and figure out what might be a good fit. It really depends on when people are available. If someone can take off their lunch break and get to a local school and wants to mentor during that time and in that way, that works. If folks are looking at doing something during the weekends and being able to go out in the community and go on hikes, there's also programs out there for that. So it really ends up being a combination of what someone has the capacity to do with their own schedule, their interests, their hobbies, and where they live. Because as we grow, we want to have more mentoring throughout the state. There's not mentoring available in every single town in the state. But we have a pretty good coverage with the 30 different mentoring agencies out there that are running programming at this point.
Yeah, you've mentioned that there's 30. What types of programs, mentoring programs, are there available to people?
So the different types, there's site-based or school-based. So that's where a mentor is going into a school during the school day, or in Burlington, the Generator has a STEM-based mentoring program where people are actually going into that maker space there in Burlington and mentoring on site. And then there's community-based mentoring where you're picking up the youth at their home, usually going out into the community and doing different things. Yet everything has changed with the pandemic, and we're slowly starting to see matches, you know, to get back to meeting in person, mostly outside with masks and distance. But for most of the last year, the majority of mentoring going around the state, regardless of model, school-based, site-based, or community-based, has been remote mentoring with a lot of texting back and forth, text communication, phone calls, video chats, and even doing pen pal letters.
Now, I want to flip it. I've been kind of asking questions from a mentor's perspective. Let's talk about the really important individuals in this process, the mentees. What ages, first of all, are they who take part in the different mentoring programs that Mentor Vermont is involved with?
So it's a wide range depending on the program. Overall, it's 5 to 22. So there's a pretty broad range of youth that are served by programs. Not every agency is serving that wide a spectrum. But we work with programs to make sure that once someone's matched, they're matched in the elementary school. When they may age out of a program that only works at elementary school, they have the opportunity to move on with their mentor onto another program that serves older youth. So ideally, folks are matched from the time that they start through high school graduation and beyond, when it really just becomes a lifelong friendship.
And what kind of interests do these mentees have?
Oh, it runs the gamut. There's a very wide spectrum of what kids are coming in interested in. And I think that's one of the great things is that the mentor coordinators around the state do such an amazing job with finding a mentee that has similar interests and finding a mentor that has a similar interest to the mentee the best they can. And even knowing that sometimes you're not going to have, you know, if someone is a game designer, well, interested in a game design, you may not find a mentor who is a game designer, video game designer, but it helps them explore a new opportunity together. And so even when it can't be a perfect match with the same interests down to the T, it allows them to really have new experiences together.
You mentioned that since 2013, you're statewide. Where are your mentees geographically in the state?
So about a third of them are in the Chittenden County area, just with the population center. And then they're sprinkled throughout the state, with a good portion down in the Upper Valley, we definitely are looking at growing our mentoring, informal mentoring that's offered up in the Northeast Kingdom in Lamoille County. Are a couple spots that we would love for new programs to start up so we can offer more mentoring opportunities to youth in those areas.
And what do these kids get from the mentoring experience, Chad?
It becomes someone that they can turn to for support outside of their immediate family. I think we all know growing up that we are where we are today as individuals because of people that have mentored us. And it may not have been a formal mentoring relationship like the youth that we serve. It may have been an aunt, an uncle, a baseball coach, someone that an adult we could turn to and look for advice, for guidance, but also just to have a lending ear. We know from the surveys that we've done with youth that they report that they feel like their mentor has made a difference in their life and that they just are there for them and someone they can turn to. I think that's been extra important during this last year in the pandemic. Youth are saying that their mentor was someone that they could depend on to being there for them when their life was in upheaval and so many different things were changing for them from school, from home life, just knowing that their mentor was going to stick with them during that time. And programs have done an amazing job of changing their support and making sure that the mentors are there for the youth that they serve and the mentor coordinators are there for both of them.
Chad, what is the mentoring effect?
So the mentoring effect, there's a study that was done a couple of years back, just around the country, trying to do a national study of how many youth out there are not having that support of a caring adult outside of their immediate family, either from a formal mentoring program or an informal mentoring program. And the study found that 1 in 3 youth are going to grow up in the U.S. without that adult to turn to, without that mentor. And that's really where Mentor Vermont and the mentoring programs in the state come in to help youth that may not have those natural mentors in their lives or may not have access to formal mentoring to gain that and have that experience and have someone they can turn to.
Now, from my experience with Everybody Wins Vermont, I know that mentoring meant going to see your mentee at school once a week. And you said that's how some of the programs are set up. During the pandemic, you've turned to a lot of virtual mentoring. Has it returned to in person, or is it going to sometime soon?
So for the community-based programs around the state, majority of them are opening back up to doing in-person. They were actually able to do a little bit of that last summer as well when case counts were down right now. So programs are opening back up in terms of in-person mentoring, allowing mentors and mentees to once again meet outside with masks and distance. As mentors get vaccinated, and actually as youth, they're also able to get vaccinated for the older youth. That will continue to change and guidance will continue to change for mentoring programs. I know I'm looking forward to getting back to seeing my mentee. I haven't seen him in person. I've seen him in person once in the last year. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity to get back once I'm fully vaccinated and have that time to be in person with him once again.
What feedback do you get from the mentees about how the experience has been for them?
It's overwhelmingly positive. I mean, I think that mentees and youth in general are just really appreciative when an adult takes time and has them as the focus of their attention. It's something that they look forward to. It's something that we see from the data. We know that we have kids sometimes that, when you look at when they're absent from school, they're never absent on the day that they are going to be mentored because it means so much to them and they want to be there.
Yeah.
And they want to see their mentor. And so the feedback we get from mentees is that it's a world of difference in terms of just having that adult that they can share how they're feeling, have conversations with them and just share experiences with them.
I will tell you from personal experience, when I started mentoring through Everybody Wins, the first, month and a half, it was during lunch. All the other kids who weren't part of the program were out in the schoolyard, and he would crane his neck and look at to see what was going out in the schoolyard. And it changed probably in that second month to telling his teacher, this is the day that Rick comes. So it certainly switched after a short amount of time. So do you hear from teachers and family members about what effect having a mentor has had on these kids?
We definitely do. I mean, I think it's we really appreciate that there's parents that are open and willing to have their youth interact with another adult that the parent hasn't met before yet either, usually. And so we hear from parents that they're just really appreciative of having that additional time for their youth to interact with someone else. And teachers express seeing a difference from kids from when they start getting mentored to where they are after being mentored for a while. And I really thank you, Rick, for being a mentor. I think it makes a big difference in a kid's life. And I want to also just make sure that folks realize we're looking for a 1 year time commitment to start. Mentors and mentees usually sign up knowing that they're committing to 1 year, be it a school year or a calendar year. And then from there, you work with the program coordinator to reevaluate, because it could be an intimidating thing to think about, you know, dedicating a year to doing something. But really, it becomes something that you look forward to. You're looking at 4 hours a month that you're doing this, meeting every week or every other week. And it really is something that you can find time to do. Hopefully, employers out there are willing to give a little bit of time for folks to go out during their lunch hour. But there's always ways to figure it out and find time in your day to get out there and work with the youth.
So if parents are listening to this and they think, oh, this would be perfect for my child, how do mentees get involved with Mentor Vermont? Do we have Chad? Chad, you still with us? All right. This might be a phone problem we're experiencing today. Chad, you there? All right. Let's try Chad back, and I'll just talk a little bit about what we're doing today. I'm speaking with Chad Butt. He is the executive director of Mentor Vermont. And we're discussing their statewide program where they have 30 organizations. If you're looking to mentor anywhere in the state, you can go through them and they can match you up with an organization, first of all, that meets your skill set and interests, and then a mentee ages 5 to 22. Usually you start when they're younger and commit to a year to begin with, and then for as long as the two of you are enjoying what you're doing. Sometimes it's a program like I was in Everybody Wins Vermont, and that was through grade school. So we went through, I think, his fifth grade, third, fourth, and fifth. Chad says you can actually transition to then another program that the two of you can move on to. MentorVT.org is their website. And Chad, you back with me?
I'm back with you.
All right. So my question was, how do mentees get involved?
So mentees can also, for parents, can go to our website as well, MentorVT.org. Often mentees are referred by their parents reaching out, just looking for the extra support for their child, or from guidance counselors to teachers reach out to us as well. And we actually have mentees that self-refer. You know, they run up in the hallway to the mentoring coordinator and say, I know you have mentors that work with kids. I want to mentor as well. And we find that there's mentees and programs that really, they figured out that they wanted a mentor, and there was the one that went out and made it happen.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, what is the process for someone to become a mentor?
So there's a lot of support and around the mentoring coordinator. So you reach out to a program. Or Mentor Vermont can help you find the program that works out best for you. There's an application process and an interview process so that we're making sure that the mentors coming into programs are the folks that we want to make sure they're working with youth, that we want to have working with youth, and also that it's a good fit for that mentor and you get to know them better. We do screening, so there's definitely a robust screening procedure. And then there's training. So it does take a little bit of effort to get started, and that's intentional to make sure we're doing a great job of finding the right match and making sure that we're getting folks that should be working with youth interacting with them. But even after the initial training and initial match meeting where you meet with the youth and usually the parent with the mentor coordinator to get things set up, there's a lot of support that goes on after that. You're never out on your own in terms of just not having anybody to support you. the mentor coordinator is there along the way to answer questions, check in with you on a monthly basis, check in with the youth and make sure things are going well. And just it's a team effort in terms of working with a child.
Is there any specific time of year for someone to enroll as a mentor?
Mentoring programs are out there recruiting right now and always. The fall definitely is a busier time for recruitment. If you want to start up a school-based match, if you want to be involved in a school-based program, September is a great time to get involved because those programs are starting up, getting up and going. School-based programs at the moment aren't recruiting because they are winding down the school year. But there's community-based programs that recruit year-round. And even if you're interested now and you want to do school-based mentoring, this is a great time to reach out just so that school programs know that you're interested and they can keep you in the loop and get you going once the school year starts back up again.
With all the screening you do, et cetera, sometimes, Chad, the perfect match isn't always made. So what happens if a mentor doesn't click with their mentee, vice versa, or if the organization just wasn't what the mentor thought? What happens then?
Yeah, a big part of the training is around closure. And we want to make sure that whenever a match ends, either, if it ends early or if it ends after multiple years or someone moves, that closure is done well and that the youth feels that they have closure and understanding why things are happening the way they are. And that does happen. And as long as it's done well, that the benefits of mentoring are still there for that youth and that mentor. And so when that does happen, often programs will try to find a new match for that mentee. Or help that mentor find another program that makes sense for them.
And how is Mentor Vermont funded?
So we have funding from independent donors and foundations and businesses out there that sponsor our events. But we grant out the majority of our funding actually to mentoring programs, and that money comes through the state of Vermont and also the A.D. Henderson Foundation. We also have a federal grant that we've been working on through the state as well. This past year, actually, we had some money come in for the Vermont Community Foundation COVID response grants, which was a huge boost for us to be able to give out that money to mentoring programs directly to make sure that they had the funding and resources they need to weather this pandemic.
And you've been around since 2003. Have you had any former mentees who have come back to become mentors?
So I actually am my former mentee from when I – back in 2004, we are still connected, and he actually is mentoring with me right now. And so we definitely have mentors and mentees come back and become mentors. Another youth that was involved in the mentoring program when I was in college down at Dartmouth actually has recently started up a mentoring program. So he's actually running his own mentoring program for youth of color down in the Upper Valley called Living Proof Mentoring. So it's amazing to see the impact mentoring can have, and the fact that 9 out of 10 youth that are mentored want to become mentors themselves when they get older.
Oh, I love it. Chad Butt is the executive director of Mentor Vermont. You can learn more at the website, mentorvt.org. Chad, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on and for being a mentor.
All right. You're welcome. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll be joined by Congressman Peter Welch. Don't forget, coming up today on WDEV, Red Sox back in action against the Detroit Tigers. That's the favorite team of former Burlington Mayor Peter Clavel. Pregame starts at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. It's been 4 months since the storming of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and it just seems that everything is quieter there now. But that's probably not exactly how it feels if you're a member of Congress and you've been putting forward and debating bills in that period of time. We'll have a chance this half hour to catch up with Congressman Peter Welch to get his reaction to the president's address to Congress, the infrastructure proposal, and more. Congressman Peter Welch, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, to ask Congressman Welch a question or to share your thoughts, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let's begin with the president's address to Congress last Wednesday. What was your reaction, Congressman Welch?
Well, I thought it was a dramatic turning point from the direction this country has been on. Basically, what he is doing, I believe, is number one, reaffirming his commitment to a goal of unity. Number two, backing that up with proposals that will be beneficial on the infrastructure and on strengthening our families and our economy, will be beneficial to people whether they voted for Trump or they voted for Biden. And let me be specific. We know we need to fix our roads and bridges. We know we need broadband, just as a couple of examples. Those will be important whether you're in a Trump district or you're in a Biden district. We need broadband for our kids to get educated, for us to work, to have access to telemedicine. Secondly, what his definition of broadband is definition of infrastructure is finally acknowledging the incredible challenges for working families. How do they take care of their kids with the cost of health care and the availability of health care being so expensive and so tough to find? What happens if you're working hard and a family member gets sick? Do you get paid family leave? And he is focusing on these things that are beneficial across the board. And what I find very appealing about that approach is that it's not a red state, blue state. It's not based on whether you like somebody or you don't. It's based on what are the shared needs that we have as a state in Vermont. It's to have good roads and bridges. It's to have access to broadband. And it's the confidence that when we work, our kids will have access to good quality health care and education. You know, he is proposing that we have 2 years of universal pre-K and 2 years of free community college, adding 4 years of education on the beginning and on the end. So I think that's a very affirmative and potentially unifying agenda.
What impact do you think the free community college tuition would have on a state like Vermont?
Well, it'd be great. It would take a lot of pressure off us. Our community colleges are very, very important, and they're a pathway to opportunity for many young Vermonters. And we need them if we're going to be able to attract Vermonters and have them be educated. But we've got a tight budget. The Vermont State Colleges have chronic budgetary challenges, and having some federal commitment to education would clearly be beneficial to the well-being of our community college system.
You mentioned that this, you know, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, red, blue, Trump, Biden, that, you know, the infrastructure program definitely benefits everyone. Maybe the difference is the price tag. You know, does the progressive side, you know, spend several trillion and the red side spend 600 billion? Is that the difference in the plans that are being forwarded?
Well, I mean, obviously price tag is always something you've got to pay real attention to. But I think when you begin, the question is, what are the needs? And, you know, the American Academy of Engineers says that on our infrastructure, we get like a D minus. And there has been decades of neglect for roads, bridges, airport, mass transit, bus lines, all these things that we need. So let's start with, what do we need? And is that a realistic number? And is it efficient? And that's a debate, because some people may think the number's lower or higher, but that's a discussion and that's a debate. Then the next question is, how do you pay for it? And, mm-hmm. You know, frankly, I'm of the view that potholes don't fix themselves and we do have to find ways to pay for it. And what the Biden plan does is a couple of things that I think are important. Number one, the international, the multinational corporations that literally aren't paying any taxes ought to pay their fair share. That's a good start. And I'll give an example. You know, Nike, which is an extraordinarily successful company, if you buy a $150 pair of Nike sneakers, incredibly expensive, you pay more for the sneakers than Nike paid in taxes, and that's not right. Second, there's been real non-compliance, especially at the high end of incomes and with multinational corporations. Fix that. Third, there are incentives in the tax code for companies to relocate offshore and ship jobs overseas. We should take those incentives away to encourage those companies to keep the jobs here at home. So these are steps that make sense to do to fix our tax code and would help us pay for some of these things that would be investments in our economy.
In his address, Congressman Welch, the president applauded Republicans for forwarding their own plan. He called for both parties to work together. I know that's a song you've been singing for a long time, but we've also seen a vast chasm between parties for some time as well. So can you convince Vermonters that things are getting better on Capitol Hill in that regard?
Well, I can't convince Vermonters until they are getting better, that they're getting better. I mean, we have two things going on in the Republican Party. You have folks like Senator Capito from West Virginia, and she's a Republican, influential Republican. She served with me in the House. She advanced the plan. You know, it's a lower number. It's less ambitious, I think, but it's serious, and she deserves to be taken seriously. And there's a number of Republicans who are in that zone. They want to be heard. They want to have a discussion with the president. And I think that's a really good thing. But there's a second wing of the Republican Party that is really alien to us in Vermont, but it's dominant there. It's the Republican Party in Washington that continues to dispute the validity of the election of Joe Biden as president. And in fact, you're seeing that play out in the House Republican leadership battles, where a very conservative Liz Cheney is the number three Republican, and she voted for impeachment, and she has affirmed constantly that, in fact, disappointed as she was, she voted for Trump. Joe Biden is the president of the United States, elected by the people. She's going to be thrown out of her leadership post. So the focus, particularly on the House side, in the Republican Party, is less about negotiating on the infrastructure deal or paid family leave or fixing our corporate tax code. It's about fealty to President Trump, former President Trump, and continuing the assertion that the election outcome was rigged. That's the real dilemma, because when you're having discussions with people who don't even accept that the president elected by the people is the president, it makes it tough to come to agreement on disputed issues.
Congressman Welch, going back to the address by President Biden, did he get the American Families Plan right? And is there anything that you would have included in that that he did not?
He did a great job in the American Families Plan. And again, what do families need? You know, they need confidence that their child's going to get a good education. What do families with working moms need? They need they need child care. And, you know, Vermont's been working incredibly hard on that. But it's a funding issue. You know, the state of Vermont doesn't have the cash to be able to come up with a fully subsidized, affordable child care system. And it's tough to impose that burden on our employers. So what the president talked about are things that all families need. It's child care. It's that pre-K, which is tremendous. By the way, our workforce challenges, the significant number of increase in people dropping out of the labor force are working women who have kids at home. So child care is good for the kids, good for the families, and good for the economies. And paid sick leave is really important. The child tax credit is enormous. I mean, this would mean that we will lower childhood poverty by 50%, and that's a $300 a month check for families where they have a child five and under. And I want to say something about Vermont and its leadership on this. You know, the Vermont Business Roundtable, that is composed of many of our biggest businesses, their main point of advocacy for, I think, a decade has been to improve early childhood education. And these are hard-headed business types, men and women, and they just see the incredible benefit to all of us if we have access to to early childhood education. So, yes, I do think that the president did a very good job, began speaking about issues that have been too neglected. And if we're successful in getting this passed, again, I want to go back to my point. It's good for families, whether they voted for Trump or they voted for Biden. And it's an element of what we need, I think, in this country to restore unity and confidence that government is here to work for everybody.
Well, your point's well taken about the business roundtable. The first time I heard them talking about it, I thought, why would a business organization like this be so vested in early childhood education? And they have certainly made their point and made it quite good, quite well, that it really is important to all that we do. I want to talk about the southern border. I don't think any American can ignore or be proud of what's happening on our southern border. What is the answer to correcting what's happening there, Congressman?
Well, it's a long-term problem. Pardon me. It's a long-term problem, and there's not an easy answer. There just isn't. At the southern border, you have a couple of things happening. One is enormous suffering and dislocation in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And it's a function of a state breakdown, violence, and climate change, where there's such incredible destitution, particularly recently in Guatemala, that people are walking thousands of miles to make an effort to get to what they think is a better opportunity. So that means there has to be work in those countries for a long-term approach where people are going to have the option not to take this desperate measure to travel up to the United States. Secondly, we have to maintain border security. You know, we just can't have an open border. The president opposes that. Every country has to have a secure border. Three, there's a humanitarian challenge because when you have these young children who one way or the other end up in our side of the border, are we going to be able to take care of them until there can be some resolution? So the bottom line here is that this is a challenge that faces our country. And whether it's Clinton, Obama, Trump, or now Biden, it's not an easy answer. And it's become politicized that makes trying to address it in a practical way even more difficult.
I know you didn't do this intentionally, but you did leave Bush out there. He would be included on that list. Let's go to Jim.
Well, you know what? That's a mistake because President Bush actually was, and thank you for pointing that out. President Bush was really good and very, very focused on immigration. You know, as a Texas governor and a border state governor, he had real experience with it and was the one who led the effort to get a bipartisan immigration reform bill passed, which did get through the Senate, but we never had an opportunity to vote on it in the House.
Let's take a call from Jim in Barry. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Congressman. You and I met over in Lindenville. We met over in Lindenville at the Foundry when you were touring it one day, and I wanted to report to you that I did get the patent. But my question is, does the latest Relief Act, you know, the payroll replacement program, do any of them help new startups? A lot of new startups were delayed significantly and probably even, you know, went underwater during the COVID time. I know in my situation, you know, we delayed a launch. But the expenses have been there for the last 3 years. It's just the money's only going one way. There's nothing to show for what they're looking for eligibility. And I'm just wondering if there's anything anything in either of those programs that would help new start businesses that had to wait because of COVID.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, Jim, I think we don't have help in the bills for that. You know, obviously the challenge would be if there's some kind of – it's pretty speculative as to how it's going to work out. I mean, I hope your business works out and works out really well. And you got crushed with the timing because things that you were planning on doing, you had to not do because of COVID. But the relief programs you have, like the payroll protection plan, that has been extremely helpful to many businesses, are helping businesses that had a record of revenues that they could point to in the previous tax year, and that was the base off of which financial contributions were made through the payroll protection plan. I'll check into it, but I don't believe that startups that don't have a pre-existing history have been helped by this by our programs, I'm afraid to say.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jim. We did have a listener who couldn't stay on the line, Congressman, who asked about election systems and, you know, what can be done to restore trust in the election systems for people. And he harkens back as far back as the year 2000 in Florida, with the Bush-Clinton debacle there with the hanging chads and everything else. But, we're seeing changes now in systems in Georgia and Texas, as a reaction to some people not believing, the results from November. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I do. I mean, first of all, there's two issues here. All right. One, is the election system functional, and are we properly counting the ballots? And, of course, then President Trump challenged that, but never produced any evidence that there was any significant voter fraud. And our elections are run pretty fairly, and people who vote, their vote is counted. And with all of the challenge around the country, and I think the Trump filed like 60 challenges in court, none of them except one on a very technical issue survived, and they were all thrown out. And that's true in Georgia, it's true in Pennsylvania, and it's true all across in Arizona. So, when we talk about election security, the reality is we have it. People are voting and their votes are getting counted. What can we do about the lack of confidence? Well, I mean, that's where Trump really is the primary person, because he is then president, was constantly peddling the argument that the only way he could lose the election was if it was rigged. And about 70% of the Republican voters believe him. So if you have somebody who at the time is president and is promoting a claim without any evidence that it's a rigged election, and folks who believe in Trump for other reasons, they like his policies and other reasons, give him credibility, then they have this view that a fair election wasn't fair. And that's just made up by former President Trump. And that is a real challenge to democracy. This is, by the way, Rick, is what I think is the most significant issue that we face as a country. Mm-hmm. Elections come and go, and you win some and you lose some. But we've had this extraordinary tradition in our country of the peaceful transition of power and the acceptance by the loser of the outcome of the election. And by the way, I've lost two elections, and I lost one by a little more than 200 votes, and I didn't even call for a recount because I had total confidence that our town clerks got it right.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have in the House of Representatives 139 members who voted against certifying the duly elected president of the United States. So that's the challenge. And now, as a result of that, you're having all these states, Georgia, Texas now, that are passing legislation, and Trump-controlled the state legislatures that are attempting to curtail access to the ballot by voters that they think will vote against them. That's a real threat to our democracy.
Yep.
And a big concern for me.
We only have about a minute left. I do want to get to the concern of someone who called last week and just called in and left this message. He said this is kind of a curveball for you, Congressman, but it's been since 1991 that the U.S. Postal Service has done a commemorative stamp for the state of Vermont, and that it's time for another commemorative stamp for the state of Vermont. So I'm not sure exactly how that works through the halls of Congress, but if you have any sway, see what you can do to get us on the schedule to have another commemorative stamp.
That's great.
It is great, right?
What a great suggestion. Yeah, absolutely. That's a wonderful idea. I'll check into that.
All right, good. Congressman Peter Welch, once again, I really appreciate you being on with us this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Great to have you. Take care. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests. Give us feedback. Love to hear from you. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.